The Works of the Reverend Hugh Binning, by Hugh Binning. Copyright 2008 Hail and Fire. This audiobook, a 2008 edition, is provided free by the Hail and Fire Library, www.hailandfire.com, for all non-profit, personal uses and distributions. This audiobook is not licensed for republication in any form without prior written consent from Hail and Fire. However, a URL link to the Hail and Fire Library may be published in order to encourage downloading of this audiobook. Footnotes have not been included in this audio edition. The Works of the Reverend Hugh Binning, M.A. One of the regents in the University of Glasgow, and afterwards Minister of Govan, collected and edited by the Reverend M. Letishman, D.D. Minister of the Parish of Govan. Preface by the editor. The Reverend Hugh Binning entered upon his pastoral charge at a very eventful period. He was ordained in the interval between the death of Charles I and the coronation of his son Charles II, which took place at Scone on the 1st of January, 1651. In the first year of the incumbency of Binning, the fatal Battle of Dunbar was fought in different parts of Scotland, three different armies, without concert with one another, subsequently took the field to oppose the progress of the parliamentary forces. And it was not till after the death of Binning that General Monk succeeded in reducing the country to a state of subjection. Meanwhile, the same jealousies and animosities prevailed, which had previously divided the Scottish nation. The nobility, as well as the clergy, were opposed to one another, and adopted different views of the national interests. And what tended not a little to increase the public divisions, the Anabaptists, Quakers, and other sectarians, connected with the English army, employed themselves, wherever they went, in propagating with great industry their peculiar opinions. By keeping these things in view, the reader will be better able to understand, in the writings of Binning, numerous allusions, more or less recondite, to the particular circumstances of the times. It was on Saturday the 19th of April, 1651, that Cromwell came to Glasgow, with the principal part of his army. The next day he went to hear sermon in the High Church. In the forenoon, he entered the choir, or inner church, as it was called, and, as Principal Bailey says, quietly heard Mr. Robert Ramsay preach a very good honest sermon, pertinent for his case. He appeared equally unexpectedly in the afternoon, in the nave, or outer church, when Mr. John Carstairs delivered in his presence a lecture, and Mr. James Durham, a sermon. Both of these discourses had, like the former one, a special reference to the existing posture of public affairs. But as might have been expected, Cromwell was offended at the plain dealing of all the three clergymen, who considered it to be their duty to condemn him and his army, for their invasion of Scotland, for the contempt they manifested for the religious institutions of the country, and likewise, for their persecution of the ministers of Ireland. On the following day, therefore, he summoned them, and the other clergymen of the city, to a meeting in his own lodgings, that he might vindicate himself and his confederates from the charges which had been brought against them, and at the same time hear what his accusers had to advance in their own behalf. At this conference, which appears to have been conducted with good temper on both sides, they who spoke most on the part of the Scottish clergy were Mr. Patrick Gillespie, principal of the University of Glasgow, and Mr. James Guthrie, minister of Stirling, who forfeited his life at Edinburgh soon after the Restoration. On the other side, the principal speakers were Cromwell himself and General Lambert, who, like many other of the parliamentary officers, was a preacher, as well as a soldier. Some of Cromwell's chaplains are also represented to have taken a share in the discussion, along with the Reverend Hugh Binning. Cromwell, it is said, was struck with the fearlessness and ability of so young a minister. "Who is that learned and bold young man?" said he. When he was told his name was Binning, he replied, "He has bound well." "But," he added, putting his hand, at the same time, to his sword, "this will loose all again." In his Memoirs of the Life of Dr. John Owen, Mr. Orme adverts to this anecdote regarding Binning, simply on the authority of a note in the Biographia Scoticana. He does not seem to have been aware that, beyond this note, there was any evidence to produce that such a meeting, as has now been described, was ever actually held. But he observes, "There is nothing improbable in the meeting, and Cromwell's pun quite accords with other anecdotes of his conversation." The part which Mr. Binning is reported to have acted on this occasion was no less characteristical of him. He was a very able disputant. But when giving utterance to his feelings, or expressing his sentiments, he was sometimes led to employ strong language. The following account of the object and result of the meeting at Glasgow is that which is given by Sir James Balfour. Oliver Cromwell, with his army, being at this time in Glasgow, had a conference with 8 ministers, anent the lawfulness of his engagement against this country and kingdom. He gave them some papers, which they answered extempore, and proud to his face his periphery and breach of covenant and loge, and his sinful rebellion and murder, contrary to the express word of God, and loge and covenant sworn by himself, and most of his complices. He took the morrow at 3 in the afternoon to his further conference with them, and many of his chiefest officers did openly acknowledge they were canoonsed in resin, and newer till now, did see the weakness of thoroughen grounds. In place of keeping the appointed meeting, saying a fear to begin to kindle amongst his own, about midnight, that same day, he commands all his army presently to march, under the pain of death, back towards Edinburgh, and empties all his garrisons be west Linlithgow, sends his horses towards the border, and with great haste, with his father returns to Edinburgh and Leith, and is now busy in repairing the breaches of Edinburgh Castle. We are informed that a report of the whole proceedings which took place on this occasion was drawn up by Principal Gillespie and Mr. James Guthrie. But whether that report is now in existence or not, or was ever printed, the writer has not been able to ascertain. The invasion of Scotland, which was one of the charges brought against Cromwell, was condemned by Lord Fairfax, the commander-in-chief of the parliamentary forces. He looked upon it as an infraction of the solemn league and covenant, which had been very generally subscribed in England, as well as in Scotland. Feeling alarm at this, the Council of State appointed Cromwell, Lambert, Harrison, St. John, and Whitelocke to converse with him, with a view, if possible, to overcome his scruples. But after a long interview, Fairfax remained unmoved by their arguments, and expressed his determination to resign his commission rather than proceed to Scotland with the army, which was preparing to act against that part of the kingdom. As he adhered firmly to this resolution, he was deprived of his commission, and Cromwell was appointed to succeed him. Whitelocke has furnished us with an account of what passed at the interview, which he and his friends had with Lord Fairfax. The views expressed by the different parties, therefore, as Whitelocke has recorded them, will enable anyone to form, it is conceived, a tolerably correct idea of the nature of the discussion which took place at Glasgow, when the same point was one of the questions at issue, and when 2 of the principal speakers were the very individuals who had previously argued the matter with Fairfax. The letters which passed between Cromwell and Colonel Dundas, the governor of Edinburgh Castle, will likewise assist us to conjecture what may have been advanced on both sides on the occasion in question, at Glasgow. some Scottish clergymen had taken refuge there after the Battle of Dunbar. It was to them principally, through Colonel Dundas, that Cromwell addressed himself. The letters were printed at the time. On examining them, it will be perceived that the invasion of Scotland, and the other offences with which Cromwell and his party were charged at Glasgow, formed in this instance likewise grounds of accusation on the one hand, and called forth a vindication on the other. In Hume's opinion, the letters written by the Parliamentary General are the best of Cromwell's wretched compositions that remain. But Mr. Orme says of them, from their phraseology, I strongly suspect them to have been the production of Owen's pen. One of the letters, dated September 9, 1630, addressed to the Honorable the Governor of the Castle of Edinburgh, and signed by O. Cromwell, contains this passage: the ministers in England are supported, and have liberty to preach the gospel, though not to rile, nor under pretense thereof to overtop the civil power, or debase it, as they please. No man hath been troubled in England or Ireland for preaching the gospel, nor has any minister been molested in Scotland, since the coming of the army hither. The speaking truth becomes the ministers of Christ. When ministers pretend to a glorious reformation, and lay the foundation thereof in getting to themselves worldly power, and can make worldly mixtures to accomplish the same, such as their late agreement with their king, and hopes by him to carry on their design, they may know that the Sion promised and hoped for will not be built with such a tempered mortar. As for the unjust invasion they mention, time was when an army of Scotland came into England, not called by the supreme authority. We have said in our papers with what hearts and upon what account we came, and the Lord hath heard us, though you would not, upon as solemn an appeal as any experience can parallel. And although they seem to comfort themselves with being the sons of Jacob, from whom they say God hath hid his face for a time, yet it's no wonder, when the Lord hath lifted up his hand so eminently against a family, as he hath done so often against this, and men will not see his hand, if the Lord hide his face from such, putting them to shame, both for it, and their hatred at his people, as it is this day. When they purely trust to the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, which is powerful to bring down strongholds and every imagination that exalts itself, which alone is able to square and fit the stones for the New Jerusalem, then and not before, and by that means and no other, shall Jerusalem, which is to be the praise of the whole earth, the city of the Lord be built, the Sion of the Holy One of Israel. This letter was answered on the same day, and in the following terms, by the governor of the castle.
My lord, yours I have communicated to those with me, whom it concerned, who desire me to return this answer, that their ingenuity in prosecuting the ends of the covenant, according to then vocation and place, and adhering to then first principles, is well known, and one of their greatest regrets is, that they have not been met with the like, when ministers of the gospel have been imprisoned, deprived of their benefices, sequestrated, forced to flee from their dwellings, and bitterly threatened, for their faithful declare of the will of God against the godless and wicked proceedings of men, that it cannot be accounted an imaginary fear of suffering in such as are resolved to follow the like freedom and faithfulness in discharge of their master's message, that it savors not of ingenuity to promise liberty of preaching the gospel, and to limit the preachers thereof, that they must not speak against the sins and enormities of civil powers, since their commission carrieth them to speak the word of the Lord unto, and to reprove the sins of persons of all ranks from the highest to the lowest, that to impose the name of railing upon such faithful freedom was the old practice of malignants against the ministers of the gospel, who laid open to people the wickedness of their ways, that they should not be ensnared thereby, that their consciences bear them record, and all their hearers do know,
that they meddle not with civil affairs further than to hold forth the rule of the word, by which the straightens and crookedens of men's actions are made evident. But they are sorry that they have just cause to regret that men of better civil place and employment should usurp the calling and employment of the ministry, to the scandal of the reformed kirks, and particularly in Scotland, contrary to the government and discipline therein established, to the maintenance whereof you are bound by the solemn league and covenant. Thus far they have thought fit to vindicate their return to the offer in Colonel Wally's letter. The other part of yours, which concerns the public as well as them, they conceive that all have been answered sufficiently in the public papers of the state and kirk. Only, to that of the success upon your solemn appeal, they say again, what was said to it before, that they have not so learned Christ as to hang the equity of their cause upon events, but desire to have their hearts established in the love of the truth in all the tribulations that befall them. Other letters followed these previous to the surrender of the castle. From them, and the public papers of the time, we discover that the English army justified their invasion of Scotland and their oppressive treatment of their opponents in Scotland and Ireland, by representing that their part of the kingdom had been previously invaded from Scotland, that the Presbyterian party was friendly to monarchy, that that party had interfered with their attempts to reform the government of England, and declared against them as sectaries, and that a second invasion of England by the Scottish nation was known to have been contemplated. On the other hand, it was affirmed that the invasion of England by the Marquess of Hamilton had been always disapproved of, and opposed by those who were now in power in Scotland, that in taking up arms against the people of Scotland, the English were proclaiming themselves the enemies of those who had formed a covenant with them, and helped them in the day of their distress, and that, although the necessity or lawfulness of a war with England, in present circumstances, had never been determined upon, nor been even discussed either in Parliament or in the Assembly, there could be no doubt a design was formed to overturn both the civil and ecclesiastical institutions of the northern part of the island, and make it a mere province of England. Richard Baxter felt the warmest sympathy at this period with the Scottish people, and with his usual intrepidity and honesty, openly arraigned the conduct of his countrymen for invading Scotland. Pinning, and the ablest of his friends, could not have pled their own cause in the presence of Cromwell and his officers with greater power and eloquence than he did for them with the parliamentary soldiers and others over whom he possessed any influence. When the soldiers were going against the king and the Scots, says he, I wrote letters to some of them to tell them of their sin, and desired them at last to begin to know themselves. They were the same men who had boasted so much of love to all the godly, and pleaded for tender dealing with them, and condemned those that persecuted them, or restrained their liberty, who were now ready to imbrue their swords in the blood of such as they acknowledged to be godly, and all, because they dared not be, as perjured, or disloyal, as they were. Some of them were startled at these letters, and thought me an uncharitable censurer, who would say that they could kill the godly, even when they were on the march to do it. For how bad soever they spoke of the Cavaliers, and not without too much desert as to their morals, they confessed that abundance of the Scots were godly men. Afterwards, however, those that I wrote to better understood me. At the same time, the Rump, or Commonwealth, which so much abhorred persecution, and were for liberty of conscience, made an order that all ministers should keep certain days of humiliation, to fast and pray for their success in Scotland, and that we should keep days of thanksgiving for their victories, and this upon pain of sequestration, so that we all expected to be turned out, but they did not execute it upon any, save one, in our parts. For myself, instead of praying and preaching for them, when any of the committee or soldiers were my hearers,
I labored to help them to understand what a crime it was to force men to pray for the success of those who were violating their covenant and loyalty, and going, in such a cause, to kill their brethren, what it was to force men to give God thanks for all their bloodshed, and to make God's ministers and ordinances vile and serviceable to such crimes, by forcing men to run to God on such errands of blood and ruin, and what it is to be such hypocrites as to persecute and cast out those that preach the gospel, while they pretend the advancement of the gospel and the liberty of tender consciences, and leave neither tenderness nor honesty in the world, when the guides of the flocks and preachers of the gospel shall be noted to swallow down such heinous sins. My own hearers were all satisfied with my doctrine, but the committee men looked sour, yet let me alone. With regard to Binning's own opinion of those whom he calls our enemies, the invaders, we find that expressed in his case of conscience. They think themselves, says he, godly and righteous, yet are not purged from their filthiness. They are given up to strong delusions to believe lies. And there is no lie greater than this, that they are a godly party, in a godly cause and way. They wipe their mouth after all their bloodshed, and say, I have done no evil. They wash their hands, as Pilate, as if they were free of the blood of those just men, whose souls cry under the altar. Like his friend Principal Gillespie, however, Binning appears to have kept up an amicable intercourse with some of the independents in the army of the Commonwealth. He even gave the use of his church to the chaplain attached to Colonel Overtown's regiment, and not only went himself to hear him preach, but exhorted his people likewise to do so. Such conduct, on his part, will be viewed differently by different people.
It will be condemned by those who are servilely attached to their own particular communion, and disposed to extend the line of separation between themselves and others, even beyond the limits prescribed by their own canonical rules, but it will be approved of by all whose charity is not bounded by their own narrow tail, who, when they agree with others respecting the fundamental doctrines of religion, would grant to them, as to smaller matters, the toleration they claim for themselves, and who, withal, believe that much of that asperity and jealousy which disturb the peace and sully the character of the Christian world would in all likelihood be destroyed and prevented, were they, who unhappily are separated from one another by names and forms, to become better acquainted with each other's principles and each other's feelings. Binning was blamed by some of his brethren for his liberality. The part he had acted was brought under the consideration of one of the inferior church courts. He endeavored to justify himself, and to show that he had done nothing inconsistent either with his Christian or his ministerial character. But not succeeding in the attempt, with true Christian forbearance, he expressed his desire to avoid giving offense to his brethren, and intimated his willingness that his conduct in similar cases should henceforward be regulated by their wishes. As a proof of the influence which, along with Cromwell, some of the independent chaplains in his army possessed over a number of the Scottish clergy, it has been asserted that it was owing to them that a change was effected in some of the forms of the Presbyterian mode of worship. It is very observable, it has been said, that all the Presbyterian ministers in Scotland made use of the Christian forms of the Lord's Prayer, Creed, and Doxology, until Oliver's army invaded Scotland, and the independent chaplains in that army thought their own dispensation was above that of Geneva. Upon this, such of the Presbyterians as would recommend themselves to the usurper, and such as had his ear, forbore those forms in the public worship, and by degrees they fell into desuetude.